Welcome to another Sad Songs podcast. Today we've got Kelsey Swain back with us.
Hello.
And we've got Ken Smith.
Hello.
And we've got Joe.
Regards.
No surname. And me. Ovary. No first name. The first song we're going to talk about today is Avril 14th by the Aphex Twin, which is from the album Druckies, Kelsey.
Yeah. It's a good album. It's, in my professional opinion, an homage to Bach's Goldberg Variations, but I think I might be alone in thinking that. But there's a heavy piano theme in everything, as is evident in this track, isn't it? But obviously it's nestled in between Koch version 10 and Mont-Saint-Michel and St. Michael's Mount, which is a great place to be, I think. I think it's prepared piano. Am I right, Kenneth? Do you know?
I don't know, but it did sound it a bit. It sounded a bit off.
I think if I'm right, it's a prepared like pianola, one of the player pianos with the sheets that he's rigged up with a MIDI controller. So, you know, quite a Nancaro way of doing things.
Yeah.
I don't know. I mean, it's sort of sad in a melancholic way, but without your usual, without the old lyrics, I guess. So what made you choose this, Stephen?
Well, I knew you would say lots of interesting things about the Aphex Twin.
He's just Aphex Twin, I think, not the...
Is there another? Is there the second twin?
No, he is just a one single twin.
How very odd.
It's quite profound when you think about it, because normally there's two.
Well, yeah. They do tend to come in pairs.
That's Peter Cook again. You've plagiarised that.
It's not Peter Cook. I don't know anything about that one.
His autobiography was called Sadly I Was an Only Twin, right?
Oh, I didn't know that. I never come across that one.
What did you think was sad about this?
Right, sadness. I don't know. Like Kelsey said, it's got that kind of. It's again gentle, kind of melancholic in a non-specifically psychological melancholic tone. You know, you're just sort of slightly downcast. I quite like the. There's just like, you know, it's like a kind of ground bass of a few chords, I think three or four chords just repeated.
And it's sort of major, isn't it?
The first chord's a minor chord, F minor, but then it's got an A flat and a bass, so it actually sounds quite major-y because it makes it sound like a major chord with an added sixth on it, which always sounds quite sort of pleasant and kind of relaxed and laid back. And, you know, all of the chords are a little bit blurry like that with these extra notes in. There's these beautiful little kinks where the rhythm sounds... I don't mean kinky like sexy kinky. I just mean kinky as in not quite right, you know, because the rhythm's also so secure. And then all of a sudden there's these little kind of kicks thrown in. And I don't know if what it looks like when it's written down, this music, but it sounded at first like, oh, it's being played wrong. But obviously, as you listen to it, you realize it's right. It's just quirky. I don't know what that added to the sorrow aspect, but it made me feel it like it makes it feel a little bit more lo-fi, maybe a little bit I don't know what's the word, like a kid's playing it or just improvising, you know, like someone's improvising on the spot, which makes it feel a little bit more raw perhaps and a little bit more emotional responsive. I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, I think with the thing is though, it sits on that album, which is a double album. And there's a few moments throughout the album where it goes back to sort of almost simple, unadulterated piano, but maybe with a few preparations or recorded in particular ways. And this is like the most normal, in inverted commas, of all of those of those sort of pivot points in the album. So it's like it's just, I mean, I was sort of semi-joking just because the track before it's called Koch version 10, but the tracks either side of it are incredibly aggressive. They are like... unbelievably, I mean, you've got to listen to them to really feel it and listen to them loud. And then this just sits there in the middle as a moment of calm, a sort of moment of, well, yeah, just take stock of what the hell's going on before it throws you back in the deep end. I think that sort of sense of melancholy is more than anything else throughout it.
Tranquility is the nice word I think of with this. It's kind of tranquil. It's kind of acceptance of a little bit of sorrow, almost nostalgia. I think part of that kind of the piano by itself often gives that sense of nostalgia. There is something slightly creepy about it. I mean, you mentioned the Goldberg Variations, and I mean, that always to me just reminds me of Hannibal Lecter in The Silence of the Lambs. But there is still something slightly a kind of a creepy edge about perhaps those little kinky rhythms, but maybe that's just me, I don't know.
Yeah, well, I think maybe. I mean, especially, look, the track three on the album is called Kladvivabungmush. which is like a really crappy spelling of Klavier Übungsmusik, which is, you know, the Goldberg connection, I think.
But, yes.
Does this one have a bit of the Schopenhauer will theory to it, Ken? Okay.
Well, I mean, put it this way, the Schopenhauer will theory is that, you know, we're all full of this kind of drive or this will. And Schopenhauer talked about music and he was saying how it's all like kind of dominant chords full of like tension that just need to resolve to like a tonic. But this song doesn't really have that because it's this kind of cycle of chords which you accept quite quickly. And none of the chords are kind of particularly full of tension. They all have some in there, but they're kind of, you're kind of happy with every chord as if it's an individual moment. It kind of makes it feel like a kind of a sensuous type of sorrow rather than like a kind of deep yearning for the next chord, you know, as if you're kind of going somewhere teleological, driving through. I don't know, do you think that, Kels?
Yeah, I think that's the, like you said about the ground figure is kind of gives you some sense of the stability there and the simplicity of that. Means that you're never worried about where it's going to resolve, I guess. Mm. It's just going to go back round.
Yeah, it's more like kind of old Baroque variations, like the Goldbergs, where you're thinking, like, what's going to happen? What's a variation going to be next
time? Yeah, yeah. How am I going to experience this next version? Yeah.
I thought you sort of played it at the beginning and then played sort of shortened versions of it throughout the next 2 minutes and then played it again at the end.
Yeah. Variations, yeah.
Minor Schopenhauer move.
I don't really know about Schopenhauer in that context. I see that more as just a kind of a, I guess, a sort of slowly changing state, kind of almost drifting from one to the next without any sort of real sense of, like, you know, you don't think at any point this song's going to, like, go somewhere. It's going to, like, a lot of the songs that we've looked at in the last few weeks are kind of clearly building up towards something. And to kind of maybe sort of cover up something that we're missing, something that we lacked. Well, I don't get the impression that this song's ever going to do that from the beginning. It feels like it's kind of accepted of its state and it's not really attempting to move beyond it just to try out something different. I think it's the difference that it's emphasizing, not the kind of projection of something that we lack and therefore need to have further down the line.
Oh, I thought in the middle bit there was some bits where there's a sort of lacking lesser version of it played and then you kind of want the extra bits.
Oh, you mean because it was like truncated slightly or
staccato-esque?
Yeah, you never get more in the middle sections where the different variations come out. They're never like fuller than the initial one. It's always a sort of partial version of the initial one, a slower version. Maybe he's missing a couple of notes out.
Oh, right. Yeah, I mean, I hadn't thought of that dimension, you know, the sort of phrase structure of the thing. I suppose also part of that, those kind of little rhythmic kicks are about a certain delay. It makes it feel as though something's not quite right that's got to be corrected next time. And when it isn't, you're kind of almost surprised by that. So, yeah, there are these little kind of injections, perhaps, then, of sort of inscribed lack, you know, something just missing temporarily that's then going to be filled. Yeah, I'd been thinking of it in the kind of harmonic dimension from what you'd said, Stephen. But, yes, I mean, you're absolutely right. That is a good point.
Has anyone idea why it's called Avril 14th?
No.
Well, it must be, I mean, April 14th, right?
Yeah, I assume so. I just know that on every electronic music forum I've ever been on, they always go crazy on the 14th of April, go, it's Aphex Twin Day or whatever.
Oh, right. See, I thought it was a misspelling of Bovril, not April.
Yeah, and it's his 14th cup of the evening.
14th cup of beef tea per night.
Maybe you just recorded it on that day.
Yeah, could be.
But you say this is a double album, Kels.
Yeah.
Are there any other tracks like this one on it?
There's some similar, not that similar. So the first track is Prepared Piano in a...
Yeah.
I mean, it could well be the same piano, but it, you know, it sounds like he shoves some pencil erasers in between strings every now and then or something metallic in a sort of John Cagey way.
Yeah.
But it's, again, it has that sense of like... The driving rhythm of a player piano or, you know, being controlled by something else. But it's a bit more weird.
I mean, this has got that music box kind of left hand, just like kind of Alberti bass, but it does feel kind of mechanical, kind of rotational sort of music.
Yeah, but isn't that exactly sort of Nan Caro way of doing things, where you can do stuff fakes the acoustic, fakes the harmonics of things by playing notes at exactly the right ratios and whatever.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. Funny enough, when we get that little sort of rhythmic kick I keep talking about, I actually thought that it was like the time signature was changing and it was becoming really complex. But actually, when I listened to it again and just sort of conducted with myself in the mirror, as one does when one's listening to obviously. A sorrowful song. Yeah, it's just perfect 4/4, but in those sort of kinks aren't like something going wrong. They're just different rhythms.
Is Joe still here and alive? Have you got a thought?
Yes, totally. I zoned out a bit, so it might be I might well repeat something someone said, although I doubt it, because you all said a lot of things I probably didn't understand. But I think this song's amazing. It was one that I had actually going to suggest anyway, but then I realized, as Steve jokingly said, I bet you have loads to say about a song with no words. And I was like, yeah. But like, the things I think is like, as a sort of feeling, it reminds me of something like Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind or something like that. It gives me that kind of feeling,
of all the films that's been used in it, isn't that? It's the crappy Marie Antoinette film.
Oh, is it? I didn't know that. Yeah. Okay, but like, yeah, that's
the rockness of it.
That's a film it reminds me of. Is that all that sort of feeling and that sort of? There's at the very end of that film. There's the excellent bit where on the beach and it just keeps looping. I'm guessing you've all seen. It sort of reminds me of that. And I like that looping, but then it sort of feels like it loops, but almost disintegrates a bit. And then you've got the weird thing with like a second piano coming in, and it seems just slightly. You've talked about kinks and whatever. I guess you're talking about the same thing.
Yeah.
Just slightly off time, or just slightly out. And I absolutely love that. It's kind of, it just adds this real fragility to it all. I mean, I find this song. I actually find this song like incredibly sad, but in quite a comforting sort of way. Like, I absolutely love it. I remember being at a friend's at like 5 a.m. after a particularly savage night, and he put this on, and I was like, oh god, like, and he was saying he finds it really joyful, but it's the only person I've ever met who finds it joyful. But I mean, his usual music is things like Pig Destroyer, so I don't know, it's a confusing mix. But I mean, I think it's brilliant, but it totally reminds me of that. Like, it should be on a soundtrack to a film like that, for me anyway. But yeah,
it's got that kind of sort of, I don't know, kind of whiteness, kind of like clinical institutional purity. I quite like that. When you said Eternal Sunshine of Spotless Mind, I always think that song's film's got a, there's something about the grain of it. I don't know, the colors in it. It's very kind of white and light gray and clean, and like the idea of wiping one's brain kind of thing. It's quite sort of cleansing, soul cleansing.
I think that's it, isn't it? It serves as a palate cleanser, really.
Yes, in the album, a palate cleanser.
It's a nice sorbet.
Yeah.
When people look back at this sort of time in the 90s and around the millennium, Kelsey, how important in the sort of history of music do you think Aphex Twin will be considered to be?
Oh, I think he's vital. He's like he's the Kraftwerk of his day. He's innovating, doing stuff with the technology that no one else could work out how he was doing until much later. And then mostly then people were doing it digitally when he was doing it. A lot of analog or early digital, not computer stuff, but, you know, literal hardware. And it took a long time for people to really catch up with that. And then obviously it may be like a lot of innovators. It's so far off the wall, so far the other way, that people sort of approach it and then maybe draw it back into something that becomes a bit more popular than he probably was. Because despite being such an innovator, he's still quite a niche market, I guess, an acquired taste. There's so much that wouldn't have happened without him innovating. I know there's others as well around the same sort of time, Square Pusher and various. He's vital.
Was he a sort of innovator in the sense that he was, you know, in the sort of popular music press and tried to make music like this, but not through a sort of institutional structure, but through, you know, selling the records?
I don't know. I mean, I've seen him play live. I don't know exactly the method he does the playing live, but I have seen him do it. And honestly, I was, you know, quite young when I first first came across his music. And so I was only there, you know, listening to the albums. But actually the first time I really encountered his music was when I went to a Stockhausen concert in the Barbican, and they were doing like, they were looking at what they were calling the technocrats, these sort of new electronic musicians of the 90s, comparing it to Stockhausen and making Stockhausen listen to their music and comment on it. Stockhausen purely just said, why are you all doing these Africanized beats? Because he's mental. But And it was just this idea that we could compare popular music with what was considered high art, and it be pretty close comparison, that this was, there wasn't a lot of ground between the two. And that definitely appealed to me as a composer, that there is this gray area where you can't just go, oh, this is high art, and oh no, that's popular crap.
Thanks for listening again. And thank you to Kelsey for coming in on these two podcasts with short notice.